Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome to the Thursday edition of the Steve Jones Show. Steve will be joining us from the Sunbury Motors studio here in just a few minutes. Got some interesting information today. ESPN saying that the longtime NFL quarterback Ryan Fitzpatrick has announced his retirement. This guy's played everywhere, just about, except Pittsburgh. He hasn't played in there, or Philadelphia for that matter. But the guy who brought us Fitzmagic for 17 NFL seasons is now calling it quits. Here's his numbers. Started 147 games, throwing for 34,990 yards, 223 touchdowns, 169 interceptions. Began his career in the seventh round, as a seventh-round pick, I should say, of the Rams in 05. He played for Cincinnati, Buffalo, Tennessee, Houston, the Jets, Tampa Bay, Miami, and Washington during his career. This guy has a whole closet that is full of hoodies, shirts, hats, and other team gear that he was given over the years. Spent most of his career with Buffalo in 53 regular season starts over four seasons with the Bills. Went 20 for 33 in that span. And also, as Steve said many times, I still think has the highest Wonderlic score of any player that has taken the test. He had a season-ending hip injury in the second quarter of the Commanders' season-opening loss to the Chargers in September, had to go through arthroscopic surgery, and basically, you know, kind of ended it, signed a one-year $10 million career or $10 million deal with Washington in March of 21. But, you know, many of us are reminded of his time with Buffalo and then thought, okay, well, you know, he's been a career backup for the most part. He's probably going to be done now. And then he just continued to, you know, play for teams like the Jets and the Miami Dolphins, had a stint as a starter there for a while, and then ending his career, as it would appear, in Washington. He attended the Bills' AFC wildcard playoff win over the Patriots in January. Watched that from the stands. And according to the one report, posed shirtless in freezing temperatures in a strong wind. Makes me want to question his Wonderlic score a little bit, but... So the Harvard grad and maybe the smartest guy to ever play football is now calling it quits. So that was the newest information of the day. Phillies actually got a win last night. I didn't have to stay up till 11 to watch them blow another lead, but it was nice. And Schwarber actually hits the game-winning long ball. This is a guy that's been rather disappointing, hitting about .185 this year. And, you know, you start looking at the Phillies and start looking at that lineup going, how in the world is this lineup not hitting? Talked about this a little bit on Monday. How in the world does this lineup not hit? And then I started looking at it. And I started looking through it. And I'm like, you know what? One of the problems is they're doing a lot of first-pitch swinging. And when you do first-pitch swinging, you know, that's not always the best pitch. In Little League, it's a different story. You know, where you're coaching Little League, you teach the kids to swing at the close pitch because their first pitch may be the best pitch you see all at bat. In Major League Baseball, it's not that way. And they're swinging at some real questionable pitches. And then I see a lot of foul outs, lot of pop-ups, and I start to wonder a little bit, you know, is it a Girardi issue? Is it the lineup? Is it a hitting coach issue? I don't know. I mean, these guys should be hitting the cover off the ball. And last night, missing Segura, who's out for about 10 to 12 weeks, and Harper sitting out, they still end up winning the game. I don't know. I can't figure the Phillies out. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later on as Steve joins us from the Sunbury Motor Studio here in just a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Howdy ho. How you?
My rant is complete.
What was your rant about?
Well, I talked about Fitzpatrick retiring, and I have a lot of respect for him. I mean, he's made a career out of playing everywhere, anywhere, and anyhow. I have all the respect in the world for him. But it's the Phillies that confound me. I mean, last night, Harper's out, Segura's out, and they bring in two guys from AAA ball that aren't bad, but, you know, they're not what I would call ready for prime time, and they win. And you have a leadoff hitter who's hitting a .185 who hits the game-winning home run. And every time I get excited and think, okay, maybe we've turned the corner, poof, it blows up.
You don't have enough bullpen.
Agreed.
It's been a constant theme for the Phillies since about, let's say, 2010.
I was going to say 2009, but you're right. Ever since the series,
you need to get lucky in some ways with the guys you get in the bullpen, for the simple reason that there's such a transient nature to it, and you're trying to bring in guys usually on 1-2 years, and you're hoping that you hit and they have a career year right when that happens, okay. And the Phillies haven't had that. They haven't had the guy, or two, and it's not just one. You need to have two guys minimum that have in that bullpen area that have career years, or close to career years. And the Phillies have it. And part of it's luck.
Well, Knievel was supposed to be part of that, but instead, this year he's become evil Knievel.
Well, I'm saying that you're hoping for that. See, all this is hope.
Hope's right? Running thin, my friend. Hope is running thin.
Oh, and look, I know that. I understand all that. But again, that's what everybody... Why are only 12 teams over 500 out of 30 in Major League Baseball?
That's an excellent question.
Right? It's a big problem. There are only 12 out of 30 teams over 500 in Major League Baseball right now. And a lot of it has to do with bullpens and some of it has to do with analytics and how the game's played and how they use their pitchers, and it's just a fact of life. And for some reason, most teams, and the Phillies are among them, it is a roll of the dice as to who's pitching the 6th, 7th, and 8th innings for your teams. And then who's your closer?
I think Joe Girardi would like to know that too.
But every team's looking, but a lot of teams are looking for that. That's why, for example, I talked about Chris Sale with Boston. He's on the 60-day IL. Okay. He is scheduled to come back in 3 weeks. And I was talking to Rob Cooper, the Penn State baseball coach, and Rob's a big Red Sox fan, just like I am. And I said, it's easy for me. I said, I'd look at him and say, you know what? No more starting. You're the closer, right? Because I don't know if he can go 7 innings anymore without developing more arm problems. So let's go out and shoot him out there 1 inning at a time and do that.
And let's not pitch him every single day either. one or two innings at a time. Give him at least a day off.
But you know what? You get to a point where you're trying to win games and you think he's, quote, your best option. And that's what makes managing so hard. You have to manage the game. You have to manage the situation, manage the game. You got to manage the week. You got to manage the season. And that's what makes the job so hard.
As Phillies fans, were we spoiled with guys like Brad Lidge, who would come in the ninth inning? Now, obviously, he had a career year in 08. There's no doubt about that. But it seemed to me every time there was a closing situation, he would come in, whether it was 3 days in a row, 2 days in a row, or not. And it seems now that closers can't seem to close 3 days in a row.
That I'd have to look up.
I mean, maybe it's just my perspective, view.
In other words, I can't give you the answer because I'd have to do research to see if guys are closing 3 days in a row because I don't know.
It seems to be, though, years ago, that was the case. Your closer was your closer. It wasn't that he pitched yesterday or 2 days.
Sure.
He was your closer. You brought him in.
I agree with that. No, I know exactly what you're saying. I do agree with that.
And I'll tell you, the other thing that frustrates me with this team is when you look at this lineup, healthy, all right, healthy, like it was early in the year, they should have been hitting the ball all over the place.
Yeah. By the way, Segura's out 10 to 12
10
weeks.
10 to 12, yeah. Because he tried to bunt. It wasn't, I think it was a good situation for him. It was just a freaky thing. And it happened one other time. I heard them talking about it earlier in the year, but it wasn't nearly as bad. But having him bunt there, I mean, I don't have any problem with it. It's just one of those things that happens. It's just unfortunate now.
Well, I mean, I asked this question straight out. You got 12 teams over 500 right now in Major League Baseball. 12. That's it. Okay. That's all you have, 12 out of 30. And you know where I think it's being reflected? Attendance. You sit there and you look at the attendance of Major League Baseball right now. Let's just quickly go through it. First of all, the A's are only averaging 7,500. That's a bad situation out there.
That's like a minor league team.
Well, Sacramento averages more than they do.
Wow.
Oh, no, Sacramento is a great draw, Kevin. Sacramento is a great draw. Always have been. And it's something about that. Or they average like 12, 13,000 a game. I mean, but Major League Baseball attendance. Let's see. I've got the numbers here in front of me.
Okay. Well, while you're looking it up, I always judge.
I've got it.
Okay. All right.
I've got it right here.
Go ahead.
All right. So somebody said to me today, oh, the Pirates swept the Dodgers. Boy, the Dodgers don't want to see the Pirates again. I said, well, based on attendance, people in Pittsburgh don't want to see the Pirates again either.
Yeah, exactly.
The Pirates are 29th in attendance, averaging 12,138 a game. Okay?
They would struggle with a buy one, get three free deal.
All right. Right now, you play 82 home games. So let's just take the 303,000. They've gone 25 games right now. So just triple that. That's 909,000. The Pirates would struggle to get to a million. Now the Dodgers are already over a million, as is St. Louis and Atlanta. Those three are over a million. So the Dodgers are one at 47.5. St. Louis is two at 38. Atlanta's at 37. San Diego's fourth at 37. The Yankees are fifth at 36. Houston, 32. Angels, 32. Cubs, 31. Giants, 31. The Mets are 10th at 31. The Red Sox are 11th at 31. Colorado is at 31. Toronto's at 29. The Phillies are at 28,108 per game. They're 14th. Brewers are at 28. Then you have a real fall off. From the Brewers to Texas, it's 5,000 fewer per game. Texas is at 16 at 23. Then Seattle's at 23. White Sox are at 23. Washington's at 20. The other 11 teams are all under 20,000 fans a game. Arizona, 19. Detroit, 19. Minnesota, good team. Minnesota's a terrific team, 18-6. Baltimore, 16-8. Cincinnati, 16-8. Kansas City, 15-8. Cleveland, 14. Guess the new nickname didn't catch on. Tampa Bay, 13-8. Miami, 12-2. Pirates, 12. Oakland, 7,547 a game. It's not translating into gate. It's not translating into gate. Like this, you know, they said, well, Dodgers don't want to see the Pirates anymore. Well, Pittsburgh doesn't want to see the Pirates either anymore.
You know how I decide if it's been a good year or not to watch a game? You look at a Sunday game and see how many blue seats you can see at Citizens Bank Park. That's how you know if it's a good season or not. If you see blue seats on a Sunday afternoon game in the middle of May and June, that's not good.
No, it's not. At all. But baseball has a lot of this. They're to blame with some of this. Sacramento River Cats attendance, just for the heck of it.
Maybe they have really good promotions.
9,338 fans a game.
Do they have a giveaway every night? I mean,
no, they just have really good. I mean, you know, it's minor league baseball, so they do certain things. The ballpark seats 14,000. But, I mean, you got to give. I mean, their attendance is higher than Oakland's. Amazing. Minor league baseball's most valuable teams. Sacramento is once again the sport's most valuable team, valued at $49 million. And they continue to average over 9,000 a game. Average cost of a family of four attending a minor league baseball game is $64.18.
There's the deal, right there.
When car repairs get difficult.
Well, I just don't know.
Me neither.
We get good. Sunbury Motors. More than quality new and used cars, Sunbury Motors specializes in complicated auto repair diagnosis. They can handle intricate repairs and even complete auto body with service open Monday through Friday, 7 till 4. And Sunbury Motors has made simple repairs easy. Maintaining your vehicle is necessary. Finding the time to do it is difficult. Welcome to Sunbury Motors Quick Lane. Open 7 till 4, Monday through Friday. Just walk in or call ahead. Relax in their remodeled waiting room with Wi-Fi, beverages, and snacks. Will Sunbury Motors factory trained techs take care of your oil change, tire alignments, brakes, and inspections. Quick Lane, 6:30 to 6, Monday through Friday, Saturday, 6:30 till 2. Sunbury Motors, Ford and Hyundai, North 4th Street, Sunbury. And Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. We take the out of auto repair.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Kia, Hyundai, great new inventory, best of new inventory in all three brands, Ford, Kia, and Hyundai, with incredible and great warranties. Great pre-owned inventory, all with the Sunbury Motors guarantee. And a great service department that makes it all happen for you. It is, inspections, routine, oil changes, And, of course, anything that's difficult, they can handle all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. All right. Very quickly, a couple of notes here for you. These will be basketball notes to start with. Musa Diabate and Caleb Houston of Michigan have decided to stay in the draft, and they're leaving Juwan Howard's program. So you've got Max Christie leaving Michigan State for the draft, Kofi Coburn, Illinois draft, Musa Diabate, Caleb Houston draft, and Malachi Branham and E.J. Liddell of Ohio State draft as well. That's among the players coming back in the conference or exiting the conference. So that's the story on that. Then there's the story of Ryan Day speaking to the group of business leaders in Columbus. And the topic was about collectives and people investing their money. This is a group of 100 movers and shakers all in the same room. And he said that in order for Ohio State to be competitive, to compete for titles, they needed $13 million a year to do that. $13 million a year in collective money to do this. Now, I know what the current numbers are. Well, current, I'll say this, is the numbers I have are as of 3 weeks ago. And I don't think it would be right for me to violate a confidence and tell you what the numbers they have right now. It's seven figures. They want to be able to, and when I say seven figures, it's low seven figures, but it's still seven figures. They want to, idealistically, by the end of the year and go through the season, they think they can quadruple the money they have now, triple to quadruple the money they have now by the end of the year, and then take that number at the end of the year and maybe even double it so it's eight figures by the time we get to this same period a year from now. That's what they idealistically want to do and what they think they can do with it. But Ryan Day outlined it in no uncertain terms and said they think they need $13 million in collective money to keep the roster intact. Now, Cleveland.com is the one that put out the story. He said, Gene Smith's unscrupulous characters are good at what they do. It's always been that way. They said, if the speed limit's 45 and you drive 45, a lot of people are going to pass you by. If you're going too fast, you're going to get pulled over. They said, I've come to the realization that every year there's going to be big time challenges, and that's just part of the job. I totally embrace that right off the bat. It's been like that every year since, and I get it. There's a lot that comes with being a head coach in college football, and certainly at Ohio State. I think the big thing about in the NIL space that's been the biggest challenge is finding what's right for Ohio State. Right now, there's a lot of risk. The risk of doing nothing is that you fall behind, and we know that's not an option at Ohio State. If you're too far out in front of it, You can also put yourself at risk in another way. In other words, he's talking about finding balance and having conversations with so many in the community around what they call Buckeye Nation is really where the challenge has been. But that's what they're talking about, $13 million. And that just gives you a rough number as to what they think it is to work with it. And that is today's, quote, marketplace. And you're talking in the neighborhood of, what, $150,000 a player? And so what do you do? What do you make the decision on? Do you base the decision on we want to get $150,000 per player, or do you want to then get 26 guys and give them $500,000? I don't know. But this is what you have to do when you're sitting there and you're talking to groups, whether you're an athletic director or a head football coach, whatever. You have to look at the landscape and what the rules are, and you've got to work around that. Penn State is third in the nation in endowments. Endowments here have been great. And Penn State's number three in the nation in endowments. Do you now shift gears and encourage people saying, look, endowing is a scholarship is great. Endowing a program is awesome. But maybe we need it to be shifted to collectives. I don't know. They're both giving. But there's a different way, you know, there's different ways of going about it. And in the collective, the athlete ends up getting some direct money. So Ryan Day set the bar at $13 million. That would include money offered to players by the outside collectives that have already been formed at Ohio State. It would include the what they have, what's called an ambassador program that you're doing there. And one thing you're not allowed to do, you cannot tie it directly to performance. In other words, hey, you get 15 touchdowns this year, you're going to get more money. But that's the plea you're hearing. You'll hear it from James Franklin. You'll hear it from Patrick Kraft as well. Time goes. You know, maybe not a dollar figure like that, but what you need with collectives. All right. Let's talk a little baseball here. Let's bring in Brian Tripp. Brian, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, I think to get there was a major accomplishment. I know we've talked about that before, but then to prove that you belong, doing it against the teams that they did. I thought going into the tournament, Iowa, just because of the depth of their pitching staff, was one of the favorites, and they had played so well down the stretch. And then in that first game, to beat the Big Ten Pitcher of the Year, Adam Mazur, and for Matt Wood to hit a three-run home run, being the big shot in that game, and to see Tyler Shingledecker go out and have the start that he did, probably the best start of his Penn State career, probably the best outing of his Penn State career, and for Travis Lunsman to follow it up and get the save and pitch just tremendous, to do that against Iowa, I thought, I don't know if they needed any validation for the season that they had, Steve, but it certainly did that. And then for as much as we've talked about Matt Wood and his draft stock, for Shingledecker to do that against the Iowa lineup, the third seed, a team that was 17-7 in the conference this year, a team that still had an outside dream of a regional 135 game, he's a draftable player too. And I think that helped his case, just getting one more signature outing. And then for as much as we've talked about Matt Wood and his draft stock and then Shingledecker, you know, Travis Lunsman has a chance to get drafted this year too. I think Josh Spiegel has an outside chance to get drafted this year too. Rob Cooper and Josh Newman and Sean Moore and Dallas Burke have done a really good job here of developing talent. Penn State had four players drafted last year, including their entire starting rotation. And then to come back this year, lose that entire starting rotation and have a better year than they had the year before, and then to go to Omaha and put together a really good showing, upset the third seed, come back and take the number two seed, Rutgers, which had an unbelievable year winning 44 games, and to take them to the brink. And that was the game. I know I talked about it on the broadcast, and I've talked about it before. That was the game. If you get through that game, you only have to win one of two games to reach the championship. You're in the semifinals. But when you lose that game, it's such a long road back. And I thought they played tough against Iowa. They didn't quit. But Iowa just had more pitching depth in that last game. And even if they had won that, I don't know that, you know, you never say never in sports, but it almost felt like once you drop into that loser's bracket and you have to win three in a row just to make the championship, it's almost the inevitable is written on your final tombstone for the 2022 season. But it really, I thought the run they had there proved that they belonged. I don't know if they needed that to prove it, but they played great against some really, really good competition, Iowa and Rutgers, probably two of the top by seed and by just the eye test to the top three, four teams in that tournament. So that was really good to see.
Were you surprised Rutgers did not get an NCAA bid?
Yeah, I thought they got completely hosed by not getting a bid to the NCAA. To go in a Power 5 conference, win 44 games, to be the number one scoring offense in the entire country. They rank statistically really high offensively in so many categories. From the eye test, looking at the lineup they had, 1 through 9, there were no weaknesses. They had a great, great season. I think right now, college baseball in general, they use and put too much value on the RPI, and I think that hurt the Big Ten this year. I think what also hurt the Big Ten this year was not playing non-conference games last year, where you didn't have a chance to develop some of your younger players and your younger pitchers to get them that action. And obviously, look, first and foremost, everyone's health and safety is paramount. But in hindsight, maybe having an opportunity in an outdoor sport where there is no contact to get some extra games by playing non-conference last year, I think that set the conference back a little this year. And the thing that I didn't quite understand, and it basically came down to, I think Michigan winning the Big Ten tournament stole Rutgers' bid. If Rutgers, number one, if they win the tournament, they're obviously in as an automatic qualifier. But you had to think it was basically predetermined that the Big Ten was only going to get two teams, and they didn't want to give Rutgers a 44-win team in a Power 5 conference and the top-scoring team in the country another bid. But the other thing, for Maryland, not only to be in the tournament, but to be hosting a regional, and then to have the number two team that was right there with them atop the standings all year and won 44 games to not even get in, that's a pretty stark contrast there, where your top team could host a regional and the number two team is not even in the tournament. I thought that was kind of something that probably needs to be looked at a little bit further as well.
What do you think the state of college baseball is right now across the country?
I think it's strong. You just look at right now, I think a lot of major league teams with their front offices, they're realizing if you're going to draft a college player, there's a lot more known quantity to it than drafting a high school kid, whether it's a really good arm or a shortstop who's excelled at the high school level. But top to bottom, there's a lot of depth. I think there's been a lot of enhancements made to facilities. There's been a lot of investment into analytics and developing players and giving them the resources they need to train at the collegiate level. I think it's really strong. I think across not just the power conferences, but you have conferences in baseball outside of the power conferences that are perennially really, really strong, especially in the South and some of the Midwest. You start going out to California. But I think it's proven for a long time that you can go almost anywhere and have a chance. If you're a good player, they'll find you in any sport, but in baseball, the depth is pretty good right now. So I think college baseball is strong. You just look at the SEC, they're running out there. I don't know if this is a great thing or a bad thing, but they're running out there 6-7 arms a night that are thrown in the mid to upper 90s. It's kind of the way the sport is trending, but also it's nice to see those guys have that in college baseball, and they're doing a good job of getting players pro-ready.
It is exactly what I said verbatim to Kevin Karstetter the other night, because Kevin's going to go to Houston.
Yep.
And I said, it's one thing about baseball. I said, Kevin, I said, baseball is the one sport, no matter what, they have the ability to find you. I mean, all sorts of small colleges, you know, JCs, you know, Major League Baseball, they scout it. They find you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the big thing about college baseball is just finding what's the right spot for you to hone your craft and develop and getting an opportunity to play. And there's so many guys that'll play at junior college and community college and then
yes.
go on to finish at a 4 or 5 year school or a Power Five, and they will find you. There's no doubt about that. And some of it with the transfer portal, and some of it's good, and some of it probably is bad, and some of it we probably won't know how good or bad it is for another 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
Because that's just the way that college sports are right now. Is I know you talk about it a lot, and I completely agree with almost everything you say on those topics.
Almost?
Almost.
Let's talk about that for a second. What do you mean almost? hockey's had some signees. Obviously, you know, that's hockey's a different kind of recruiting. It's you know it's a different kind of roster makeup. It's older. But how do you think they feel about how things played out in terms of the roster with ice hockey?
Yeah, and I think Guy and his staff has always done a really good job of making sure if they're going to bring someone in, it's going to be that fit piece, that fit piece is going to be right. And they brought in two transfers along with their freshman class that they feel like, number one, fit needs they have, but also for all the hard work they did last off season and last season on and off the ice to get the culture in the locker room to where they want it. After, as guys admitted, during COVID, it was tough. It was tough on him. It was tough on the program to form those relationships and those bonds. The two guys they brought in, Ter Linden and Ashton Calder, are going to be not only really helpful players on the ice, but two guys that are going to fit in that locker room as well. I think they feel really good about their roster. It's a veteran roster. It's an older team. If you just look at the makeup of the Big Ten compared to Penn State,
mm-hmm.
outside of Notre Dame, there's a lot of younger teams in the conference. I think that will help them. You bring back a lot of key players who now have had the experience. Like, sure, Connor McMenamin and Kevin Wall and Connor McEachran were a part of that 2019-2020 team that won the Big Ten regular season championship. But because that year was cut short from COVID, they didn't have a chance to play in the postseason. They were, quote-unquote, fourth liners. They weren't on special teams units. They weren't on the power play. They weren't out there at the end of the game with 2 minutes left needing to block shots and prevent the other team from scoring with the extra attacker on. They weren't out there on the ice with 5 minutes left down a goal. And to get those reps last season with fans back in the building, I think that will go a long way. So now you'll have the experience on the ice to match having that junior or senior designation next to your name going into next season as well.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking today about name, image, and likeness, and
mm-hmm.
Ryan Day made a speech yesterday in Columbus.
Yep.
For some odd reason, I lost my invitation here. I wouldn't have gone anyway. And he said,
you aren't going to contribute to the $13 million they need?
But that's the number he came up with. Now, I know what mm-hmm. the numbers and the goals are with the collective here, because, I mean, I talked to Mark about it.
Yep.
I'm not going to reveal what his numbers are, but it is the goal is to get it up to, okay, safely you can say get it up to 8 figures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, $13 million for a roster? I mean, that's where we are right now. What about the other teams? I mean, and I said, you got to keep your football, basketball, like in the black. That way, to me, that's where, and then it trickles down to the other teams. And you do a lot of work with baseball, with men's ice hockey, you know, besides being the, you know, the major domo in football, and you know, and and I mean, how do they? What do they think about this? When you talk to the players or to Rob or to Guy, what do they think about collectives with football and basketball and things like that and about about them?
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for them, but I think you get the sense being around those programs that, and I've done a lot of podcasts and interviews with women's soccer and men's soccer and softball. There's a cognizance of what is happening. But I think those sports, because it is so new and so fresh, and there's so much gray area, that what happens with football as that domino continues to fall, or at least the first couple dominoes continue to fall, is going to be a read and react and a learn what happens from football and men's basketball first. Not that they don't have to discuss it and think about it and try to use it to your advantage and plan for it, but it's on a much smaller scale. And then once the football domino or men's basketball domino starts to fall, then they're going to learn more from that. Like, yes, it is happening in hockey. It's happening in other sports, but not on the scale that it is from the jump in football and men's basketball. So I think... yeah, you have to educate yourself and learn about it, and you want to be on the forefront and ahead of the curve. But what's happening in football is at Indy 500 speed. Meanwhile, the rest is kind of at the speed you and I would jog a 5K.
Yeah. I wouldn't include me in that. That'd be going backwards. My friend, thanks so much. Appreciate it. We will see you. I hope I'll see you tonight. I don't know if you're coming over this event or not, but hopefully you'll be there.
May be there. We'll look for you.
Sounds great.
All right.
Ivan Mazel coming up in the next half hour, brought to you by Sunbury Motors here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.